You're listening to the Save the Marriage Podcast. Your marriage can be saved and strengthened if you have the right information. Join Dr. Lee Baucom as he explores ways for you to improve your relationship and your life, starting right now.
Hey, this is Lee Baucom, and this is the Save the Marriage Podcast. This is the podcast that's devoted to us talking about how you take the next steps in saving your marriage, how to understand different areas, not just if your marriage is in a crisis point, but just on how to get a marriage just out of stuck points to a place where you want it to be, a place where you would treasure that relationship. And today is one of those podcasts that applies really across the board to marriage. Today, I want to talk about the three things you must do after an argument. Now, I say after an argument for the simple reason that there's been plenty written about how to not have an argument. And what I've witnessed is that that tends to fall on deaf ears. For whatever reason, we still get into arguments. And so part of the task is, what do you do after the argument, after it's already erupted? Over and over in my clinical practice, I had people come in, and then the problem, as I saw it, was that their whole process of being able to converse with each other was not a conversation, but an argument. And so they would come in talking about how they needed new communication skills. But my problem with that was, if you teach somebody better communication skills, they only get better at arguing. They're more effective in their argument. They don't ever learn that what's behind that is how they're really connecting with each other and perceiving each other. And so today I want to talk about what happens when the argument's over. What do you do? Before we get there, though, I want to talk and kind of set the stage for what's going on here. You know, why is it that we get so caught up in arguments? And when I say we, I mean I raise my hand, we, because I don't know many people who don't get into arguments, with maybe the exception of perhaps monks that have taken a vow of silence, and maybe they even do it, you know, just with hand signals. I don't know. But I think pretty much a basis of how we, unfortunately, as humans communicate is through arguments. And one of the reasons is because we all have a built-in belief that we are right, that the way we see the world is correct, that the way I understand my reality is the correct understanding of the reality. And I say that we all believe that for one simple reason. If I didn't believe the way I saw the world was correct, I would change my view of the world. And so by the fact that I believe my way of viewing the world, by the fact that I stay with that belief system, means that on some level, I believe that the way I see things is correct. It's right. It's the correct way that everybody should see things. Now, you know, in my moments of reflection, as I say that, I know that I can believe that somebody else can see things differently. You know, if all you have to do is open the internet and look on some web pages, or open the paper and look on some stories, or watch television and realize that people all don't see things alike. And so it's not that I am not aware that people might see things differently. You're aware that people can see things differently than you. The difference is, when we really boil it down, how we see things is what we believe is true. Otherwise, we would change to another viewpoint. And so we all have this built-in bias about the way we see things ourselves. And unfortunately, because of that, we tend to be surprised when other people don't see it the same as us. When other people see it differently than me, I have to admit a little bit of surprise, even though there's a part of me that knows that all the time, especially when it's somebody so close to me as my spouse. You know, I would assume that she's going to see things just alike, and yet I know that's not the case. So the first reason we argue is because we truly believe on some level that I am right, that you believe you are right, that each person believes that their way of understanding the world is right. We also have a second belief that anybody sensible would therefore see it our way. And this is especially true when there is a decision to be made or there's an opinion out there. We begin to believe that if we see it right, that if the person only understood what we understood, that they would see it right, that they would see it our way. And so we have this built-in belief system. Now, notice those two are fairly benign on the outset. They're true for all of us, that we believe that we're right. And I believe that if I just showed somebody why I'm right, they would get on board with me and agree with me in being right. So what gets all that in trouble? Well, the third reason we argue is that because we get caught in the need to A, be right, and two, or B, to win? We have two of those competing things going on at the same time. First, we want to be able to walk away, and there's this idea that cognitive psychology tells us that we want to always be consistent in how we see things. So when somebody challenges the way we see things, we have a need to tamp that down, to be able to get to the place where we're back to feeling like the way we see things is right, to have cognitive consonance instead of cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is when you have two different ideas running in your head at the same time and you have to choose which one you're going to go with. Cognitive consonance, on the other hand, is when you're in agreement. How you see things is it's all the same. You know, you just know that you're right. And so everything's fitting together in your thoughts. And so when that happens, we have these two things happening at one time. One is the fight-flight response that we all have. That's a very primitive part of our system, where when we feel challenged, we will do one of two things. We will either try to get out of the way of the situation, we'll flight, or we will take on the other person, we'll fight. It's a very deeply seated piece of our psyche that we can't get rid of. It's actually in our brain. Our brain is wired to get into that because it's a survival mode. Think when a threat wasn't about a disagreement with a spouse or a friend or a boss or a coworker or maybe even someone underneath you, but the argument was about survival. Maybe it was with somebody who was really coming at you with a weapon or an animal that was out to, you know, have lunch. And at those points, we needed to have a strong fight or flight response. Somebody who was able to sit there and go, you know, I really don't know if this is a threat. Maybe, maybe not. I'll just hang out and see how this goes. I'll just hang loose a little bit. Ended up not passing their genes on, because they were eliminated long ago. And so we've ended up with a gene pool that is tightly attuned to threats around us when those threats are no longer around us, that we're still looking for those danger points when those danger points don't even exist anymore in for most of us in any reality. For anyone who's certainly listening to this, you're not likely to have the moment when right around that corner is an animal ready to devour you. We might feel that way if we're in a downtown location or in a dark, shadowy garage or something like that. But for the most part, most of us go through our day-to-day life, week to week, month to month, year to year, without any real mortal threat to ourselves that ought to trigger a fight or flight response. And yet, people have that same trigger response multiple times during a week. So we have this tendency of jumping into a fight-flight response. And then the other is we have a need to save face. And so none of us want to say, oh, you know what? You're right. I'm wrong. And because of that need, we get trapped in constantly trying to prove ourselves right when we get in the midst of a conflictual situation. The problem is arguing doesn't solve it. It doesn't get us to that point. It gets us stuck. So let me just kind of define an argument as two people with two different points of views trying to convince the other person, but neither one will shift. Two people, two different opinions, trying to convince the other to shift, and yet neither will. That is, in my mind, the definition of argument. Most arguments aren't about things that need to be solved or fixed or decided. They are about different points of views. There are some arguments that need to be decided, but they're rare. They're rare in life. How many times do you watch two people arguing about who's going to win a game when in reality has nothing to do, or who's the better game when, or who's the better team, when in reality their viewpoint's not going to change anything about that game? Same with the spouse. How many times do we get in arguments about things that just aren't going to matter? So what I think is that we have this cascade, that we go from conversation mode, where we're just talking, to conversion mode, where we're trying to get the other person to see it our way, to conflicted mode, where two different people are trying to get the other person to change. And so because of those opportunities being more the case with spouses, I mean, you have more conversations that have some meat behind them, some importance to them, or at least seeming importance to them. That means that a marriage is more likely to have the more painful and more difficult arguments. You know, if I have a difference of opinion with one of my friends, I can just stop hanging out with them, or I could at least put a break on it for that point and go home, or change over to the weather or something else. You know, there's always something I can revert to not so much so with a spouse. We get caught up in that conflicted mode much easier. So we go from conversation mode to conversion mode to conflicted mode much quicker with a spouse. Conversation mode is when we're just chatting. Conversion mode is when we realize that we're seeing things differently and we got to get them back to that correct viewpoint, mine. And then conflicted is when both people are doing that and it is stuck. So arguments also don't work because it creates a rush of adrenaline through your system that shuts down your neocortex but excites your amygdala. So just to pick that apart, you have this cascade of chemicals in your body. And you know that rush of adrenaline. It's the same rush of adrenaline you get when something scares you or excites you. But when it happens, it immediately has a reaction in our body that is putting us on guard. And so what happens is that it starts shutting down our sensibleness. You know, the part of you that goes, why am I even having this argument? This makes no sense. And yet you continue on is telling you that your neocortex is getting shut down. The part that says we've had the same discussion over and over and we never solve it and it's not going to get solved again tonight shuts down. And what takes over is the amygdala. The amygdala is the part of your brain that is looking for threats and is trying to figure out how to deal with the threats, the most primitive part of your brain. And so when that rush of adrenaline hits, and you know it happens, you know that look when a spouse gives you or that tone in a voice that you know you're headed for an argument, it kicks in adrenaline, and off goes your thinking part of your brain, and on goes your guard part of your brain. And at that point, you're in a fight or flight mode, and you're not going to solve it. So then what happens is that it quickly devolves from the initial reason to all the other parts. Have you ever noticed that in an argument where it starts off about something you thought might be important to discuss, and pretty soon you're talking about all the problems you've ever had in your relationship, and that first date you had, they went bad, and all the anniversaries that went downhill, and the birthday presents that didn't work, and the holidays that didn't work out, and the vacation that stunk, and the kids that were acting out, and all the other parts of life that suddenly come out and get thrown on the table in the midst of an argument? At that point, you know you're just going for the win, right? You're taking the other person down, and whatever it takes to throw at them, you throw at them. You don't have weapons, so you have words, and they're much more hurtful. And so it devolves away from the initial reason for the discussion into an attack on the welfare of the other person, the sensibility of the other person, the sanity of the other person, and the sensibility of this relationship very quickly. So then let's talk about some things you need to do. These are the three things that you need to do after the argument, and it is not about the apology, right? I want to say that an apology is important, but that's not what I want to focus on, because there's another learning piece that's critical to get to before we ever get to that place where we make a significant apology. You ever made an apology and your spouse said, I don't think you even mean that. I don't even think you know what you're talking about. You're just not wanting to argue. That's when the apology is based on ending the argument and not about understanding and getting behind it. So it feels superficial because it is superficial. It's about wanting to move on. And unfortunately, once you've entered into that area, there's something else that needs to happen in the background. So let's talk about those three things that I think must happen after an apology in order to get to a better place. The first one is to take responsibility. Take responsibility for what your role was in the startup of that argument. How did it get from a conversation to an argument? What was your role in that? And when I say that, I mean to sit down and really think back. How did you enter into that? What was it that triggered it? Was it something that you were responding to? Or maybe it was something you did that your spouse was responding to that was throwing on that initial flame into the argument? At what point did you go from the discussion part to the argument part? And to be able to take responsibility, I don't mean this in terms of with your spouse. This is an internal process. All three of these pieces are internal processes for you to get to a different place. You see, the reason it's important to look at your role in this is because we all want to see ourselves as innocent of really being the reason for that. We all have the fantasy of innocence, that we've been done wrong. Just for a moment of vulnerability for yourself, how many times can you think back and realize that maybe after an argument, you went and you told someone about it? And I'm not talking about an argument with your spouse, but just in your life where you told somebody about that, and you realize that in some ways you were framing the discussion with this other person so that you looked like the good guy. You were framing the information you gave them and maybe, you know, even where the discussion started and what was said and how it was said, and all of those pieces are aimed at putting the responsibility of the whole argument on the other person. Just think about that for a minute, because I can tell you, as I look back, I can see many discussions I've had with people where I was framing it as me being the innocent person, me being the guy done wrong, right? And I'm not talking about just in love, but just in life, in discussions with people where, you know, somebody might have treated me wrong, where I've framed it in a way where I am totally innocent. You know, that all I was doing was being the hero, because we all make ourselves out to be the heroes of our own story. There's nothing wrong with that. But it does get us away from being responsible for our role. And here's the little kicker. We always have a responsibility in an argument. We always have a responsibility, even if it's to say, I responded to that person. I shouldn't have responded to that person. And so it might just be that you said anything. You started up, you had any conversation. But what I want you to really think about is, where did you begin to step into it? Where did you get entangled in it? Where did you find yourself stepping into this argument? And to be able to take responsibility for that, to step back and say, I did that. This was my role in this argument. This is not to take 100% responsibility for the argument. This is not about the blame of the whole argument, but to be able to be responsible for the fact that you were responsive in this argument by being reactive. And so as you look at that, to be able to say, okay, how did I step into that role? Whenever we pretend that we have no blame in this, no fault, and no responsibility, we're headed to repeat it again, because we'll repeat our own behavior. We'll do the same thing over again if we're not willing to look at it and say, oh, that's what I did. That's why I am responsible for this. I set this up. And so you have to sit down and say, okay, I've got to accept A, that I have responsibility in this, and B, to examine what that responsibility is. How did I enter into this? How did I create the problems? And how did I perpetuate the devolving piece where it went from conversation to conversion to conflicted? And be able to take responsibility for that. That's the first step. Until you're able to do that, you can't do the second one. The second step is to consider what was threatened. What got hooked in me? Why did I get all hooked up in this discussion? You ever had those moments when after an argument's over, you walk away and go, what was that about? Why did I even walk into that? Why did I even keep that up? Because there's something threatened. Something in there is threatened, and it may just be the threat that you might not see things right, that maybe the other person gave you a different perspective. It might be that the threat was that life was going to change, right? That somebody says, you know, you're a horrible person and I can't be here anymore. And that elicits an argument, because what's threatened is a life that you want to keep. And so whenever there's a threat, we're going to respond in less than helpful ways. Remember that amygdala gets very easily triggered when there's a threat. And so the consideration is about what was threatened, what hooked you. It's very important to be aware of that. You don't have to decide whether it was right or wrong to be hooked by that, but just to acknowledge that that's what hooked you. So the second thing is to consider, what was threatened? Why did I bite the hook? Why did I go after this? Why did I decide to jump in after this? Then the third step is to examine when it loggerheaded, when it got stuck, when the conversation was screeching to a halt. It doesn't mean the conversation was over. It just means that the conversation was no longer moving forward. It was an argument. And so the no longer moving forward could be that you stopped talking at all, or it could be you kept on talking, but it was going nowhere. The two of you were going through the same lines over and over again. Have you ever noticed that? Then an argument is running the same lines over and over. You're repeating the same things over and over. You might say it a different way. You're just expecting the other person to finally see that you're right. And so you keep saying it over and over again in different ways, in different intonations, in different sarcastic tones, in different pleading tones. And at that point, you know you're stuck. So consider these questions when you're trying to figure out where it got stuck, to say, was I stuck in this belief that I was right? And can you suspend for a moment the possibility that maybe you weren't right? So you ask the question, was I really right? I mean, as far as I'm walking away convinced that I'm right, was I really right? Do I really believe that? Am I really as bound to this belief system as I have pretended to be? Do I really buy that I am 100% right? Or the second piece is to consider, am I self-justifying? Am I trying to prove how I'm right about this? And so I keep circling back because I'm trying to prove that I'm right. That can keep you stuck. And the third thing to consider is, was there a decision that, and is there a decision that must be made out of this? Is there something that needs to happen? Was there something we really need to decide that we didn't get to? So that can let you know that there's a danger point there, that the reason you got stuck was because that issue, that decision that was being made, was somehow threatening and scary and frightening and whatever else it was. But you have to be clear that there was actually a decision that needed to be made. See, we often apologize just to move beyond the argument, but not to take responsibility. And as long as we secretly believe we're right and the other is wrong, there's little room for any significant shift. All you can hope is that it blows over, not that it gets better. So in order to get to a useful apology, we have to go through these things and say, okay, what was I responsible for? Because then your apology can include what you were responsible for. You can apologize for how you entered into that specifically. That feels a lot more real than I'm so sorry about that argument, but I still know you were wrong, because that's kind of what ends up feeling like in many apologies. When we know it was threatened, we can also voice that. You know, it got really scary to me when you said blah, 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 and that really felt threatening to me because blah, blah, blah. And then why do you examine where you got stuck? Because then you can say, you know, what I realized is whenever we talk about the kids, the money, whatever else, we go in circles. We either make no decision or we keep talking about the same decision over and over again. And I'm wondering what that's about. Do you see what happens to your apology? It suddenly has some teeth to it. It also takes you out of the hero role and makes you human. Makes you just a regular person who doesn't always see things exactly right, who doesn't always have the right answer, who doesn't always have to prove the point, but can live in the fact that maybe there are some other options that are just as worthwhile. Doesn't mean you're wrong for somebody else to have an opinion that might matter. So as long as we secretly believe that we're right and the other person is wrong, we're stuck. And this is a way of beginning to break that down. Now, let me clarify here. You know, somebody might feel like I'm saying that you're always wrong. No, I'm not ever saying you're always wrong. You're not always right. You're not always wrong. But what I am saying is most arguments are on things that do not need a resolution, and they don't matter in just a short amount of time. And there is no clear-cut right. Notice those pieces. They're based on things that don't even need to be resolved. Sometimes it's an opinion. Sometimes, you know, it's a thought about somebody else, a belief about something else, or maybe even some parameters of parenting or spending money or whatever, not something about what's happened right now. Sometimes it's even about what something has already happened that you can't undo. And so it doesn't need a resolution, or it doesn't need a decision. Often, you know, if you looked at that in 15 minutes or 2 hours or 2 days or 3 days or 5 weeks or however, you look back and you can't even remember what you were arguing about. Can you think of those times when you have been tooth and nail in an argument and you can remember that you were tooth and nail in an argument and have no idea what that argument was about? And sometimes what you would say is, oh, I remember what it was about, but geez, that was crazy. And so we often get stuck in those arguments that have nothing to do with what we need to do, actions that need to be decided, or even opinions that are as clear-cut as we pretend they are in those arguments. So one of the quotes that I love is what Richard Carlson said in Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. He said, "You can either be happy or you can be right, but you rarely get to do both. You can be happy or you can be right, but you can't do both." And so that's part of what happens in conflicts is we are siding with being right over being happy, even though right, I put in quotes, is a relative term. That there are lots of ways you can be right on lots of different things. And so we have to be deciding, am I always going to just try to prove that I'm right? Or am I always going to try to work on being happy? Those are really the two options that we have. Part of what you're trying to discover is what your Achilles heel of arguing is, so you can reduce it when it happens. Those danger points that pull you in. When you reduce the number and ferocity, then there are resources to deal with the important arguments. And what I mean by that is we tend to have the same little things that we fall into over and over again, and so we get perpetually in arguments. And so the rare times when something has to be decided, we live from such a threatened model that it makes it very hard for a couple to make the decisions because they just know they're going to end up in an argument. So when we can figure out why we keep getting triggered, then we begin to monitor for that, and we begin to reduce the number of arguments and the ferocity of the argument, the how long it goes and how loud it becomes and how mean it becomes. And then suddenly the resources that have been put into that kind of conversation, that kind of argument that's useless, can be used when there is an important conversation that needs to be had, a decision that does need to be made that's going to be contentious, because those do come along. It's just that out of 100 arguments, probably 80 of them needed nothing to be decided, and I'm even being conservative with that number. I would guess that usually it's about 90 to 95 of the arguments out of 100 have no need for resolution. But often it has become habitual. We get into the habit of arguing, and it becomes more of a reflection of the deep hurt that we have that we don't feel like is resolved. And then so then we have two people who are working from a deep level of hurt. We have to break the habit. So how do you break the habit? Okay, this is prevention now. Now we've talked about what do you do, and I would suggest that you keep doing that with every argument, because in every argument, you begin to untangle why you're getting into that, and then you can begin to work on the prevention. The first one is to watch for the habitual bait. Habitual bait is when you keep biting at the same issues with your spouse. Something comes up and it never gets solved, it never gets fixed, and you keep having the same argument. I used to love to ask couples, what's the first argument you remember? Not just the little tiff, but the real first big argument that you had. And we would work down to get to the underlying issue. And then I would point out that they have continued to have that same argument their entire marriage. Generally, the first big argument that we have, we'll point out the issues that are going to be recurring until we finally fix them. We just don't fix them in the argument. So you have to watch for the habitual bait. It's kind of like a fish. You know, someone throws out that lure and they bite. And then next time they bite it again. And the next time they bite it again. And the thing we know about fish is they will keep biting the lure. They don't get smarter over time. They keep thinking that they finally have come upon something they can take on and something that will be lunch. And so they get caught again and again. Is that going to happen to you? Or do you say, you know what, I'm a little smarter than that. I'm not going to keep taking the bait. So how often will you continue taking the bait? And that's going to take some practice to step away. The second is to listen. To listen so deeply that you might just be changed to the other person's opinion. It's not about as they're talking, you're rehearsing the next line and you're looking for the next place to go. You listen to what they're saying and you repeat it back to them until they say, yep, you've got it. Okay, that's an important part because that breaks the conversational habit of arguing. Arguing is based on not listening to the other person, but knowing where you're going next and thinking about the strategies you're going to use to turn their words against them and overwhelm them with your words and do all those tricks that might be great if you were in a courtroom with a judge who's going to rule one way or the other, but it doesn't work when the two of you are trying to come to the resolution. The two of you will not work as judges together. It just won't happen. So don't rehearse your lines. Listen to what the other person says. Listen so intently that you may allow yourself to be convinced that they're right. If not, you can at least get to the place where you can say, okay, I understand what you're saying. Obviously, we don't agree on that, but I understand what you're saying. So many arguments would disappear if both people just felt understood. So be the person who starts that. Be the person who begins to move towards that understanding. Third thing is to consider, is this something that needs to be decided? Are we discussing something that really does need a resolution? If not, you may decide just to not continue that conversation. So then you're just listening out of curiosity to help you understand how your spouse sees things differently than you. That's a great exercise, just to try to see things through the other person's perspective. And so you keep asking questions and you just keep listening, knowing that there's really nothing that's got to be resolved here. It's just a matter of getting to know your spouse better and getting to understand how your spouse makes sense of the world. And then the fourth idea of prevention is to use some structure. You may decide that, you know, you're going to talk about this for 20 minutes, and if you can't get to a resolution, then you'll take a break and come back to it later. It's not 20 minutes and there's never going to be talked about again. Let's just shove this under the rug. It's 20 minutes. Let's take a break and we'll come back to it another time. Another way you can use a structure is an issue card. An issue card is when you write down what you're discussing on a card. And this is if you both can agree that it never goes anywhere good. So you write it down on a card. And then every now and then, you look at the card and see if you're talking about that. And if you're not, time to stop and re-gear back to what's on that issue card. So the discussion may be how we spend our money. And then you keep asking, are we talking about that? Or are we talking about, you know, your character flaws and how I could have done so much better and why, you know, go on and on down the list that destroys the relationship because those things aren't meant, but they are felt by the other person. And then you might add a structure of taking turns where each person cannot speak until the person says, okay, I'm done, your turn. So you keep taking turns on how that discussion is going to go, and then you just have to listen. The other one I love to do is to have a couple do a pro-con. You've already decided something's got to be decided. And so the two of you together work on a pro-con analysis. And you know the pro-con analysis where you just write a line down the middle of the page and each of you can talk about the pros and cons of the decision making. This is a wonderful tool because it pulls you together to really look at what's behind it, not the argument in front of it. You start looking at what's important to each of you in those matters, and it begins to be not just a way of analyzing and making a choice, but also of understanding where each of you is working from, what your presumptions are, how you understand those things. Okay, and the last thing you do for prevention is work on connection. You work on being connected other times because here's the thing. The greater the connection in the relationship, the lesser the arguments. Conversely, the lesser the connection, the greater the arguments, and it begins to be a building cycle. So the more connected you are, the less you have arguments. The less you have arguments, the more connected you feel. Go the other way. The less the connection, the more arguments they have. The more arguments you have, the less connected you feel, and around we go. So it builds one way or the other. Which way are you going to let it go? So to remind you of the three things you must do after an argument is, number one, take responsibility. Look for your role and how it got started. Number two, consider what was threatened. What felt threatened in you? What made you get into that fight-flight mode? What were you scared of? What were you hurt by? What were you angry about? And that will tell you where you got hooked. And the third thing is to examine how it got stuck. What were you doing as it got stuck? Were you at a place where you're trying to prove you were right? Did you get stuck in trying to self-justify? Was there even a decision to be made? Those are the three things you must do. Okay, hopefully that's given you some ways of really changing your discussions with each other so you're no longer stuck in having to live with an argument. This is what you do after an argument because that will help you prevent arguments in the future. Now, if this was helpful for you, I would love it if you would help me share the word. If you could spread the word about this, because let's face it, everybody argues. This might be useful for your friends, for everybody else. You can share it on Facebook. There's a Facebook share button just underneath this. You can share it on Google+, LinkedIn, and all the other social medias just below, just by clicking those. You can also send out a little Twitter love. If you're on Twitter, you can send out a tweet for me, and it's easy. It's pre-populated. All you have to do is type in your browser. You just type in SaveTheMarriage.com/love. That's SaveTheMarriage.com/love, and that'll pre-populate the Twitter feed, and you can just hit send. You can change it to whatever else you want, but it gives a link on how people can find it. If you're listening in iTunes, please give us a review. Please let other people know that you're getting benefit from this, and let us know if you're not getting benefit, how it would be beneficial. So let other people know with the review. If you have some feedback for us, send it to podcast@SaveTheMarriage.com, and that's a good way of giving us feedback, as well as the comments section just below. Say some other ways that maybe you've escaped the whole argument pattern, and maybe some ways you disagree with me about that. Maybe you think that arguments are a good way of having a conversation, and let us know in the comments area below. Otherwise, know that we're here for you. We're here to help you. We're here to try to give you advice on how to save your marriage. If you haven't gotten it yet, you can find the Save the Marriage system. Just go to SaveTheMarriage.com, and that'll get you access to the Save the Marriage system. And you can find my book, which is available both as a Kindle book and as a regular book. That's How to Save Your Marriage in 3 Simple Steps, just by going to SaveTheMarriage.com/Kindle. That's SaveTheMarriage.com/Kindle, and that'll get you that resource. Until next time, I wish you the best as you're working to save your marriage.
You've been listening to Save the Marriage Podcast. For more information and help, please visit us at SaveTheMarriage.com.